Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to us here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM. And speaking of cool jazz, that's Caledonia by the great Louis Jordan, who passed away on this day in 1975. And we are about to start a conversation here on the weather. Let me remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to testing, you can learn about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's MarylandEducators.org, or at SteinerShow.org, click on the Maryland State Education Association's banner. We're about to tackle a subject that seems to be gripping America at the moment, and one that really causes a lot of consternation for many people. There's been this outbreak of measles in Disneyland that caused this latest conversation about the efficacy of vaccines. And we see Republican governors and senators saying they should be voluntary at best, and that's caused a political uproar around this issue. There are people who are link the notion of the vaccines to the growth of autism, the unexplained growth of autism in our culture, among other diseases. And so we're joined here by two physicians to kind of wrestle through some of this stuff with all of you. Please join us with your thoughts. I know many of you have written in about this and are thinking about this. The number here is 410-319-8888. Log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet me at Mark Steiner. Send us an email at talk@steinershow.org. But call if you can, 410-319-8888. We're joined in the studio here by Dr. Andrea Berry, who is an assistant professor in the Division of Infectious Diseases and Tropical Pediatrics in the Departments of Pediatrics and Medicine, the Center for Vaccine Development, University of Maryland School of Medicine. Good to have you in the studio, Dr. Berry.
Thank you for having me.
And joining us by phone, by ISDN, is an old friend, and Dr. Julia McMillan, Executive Vice Chair in the Department of Pediatrics at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, where she is Professor of Pediatrics and Associate Dean for Graduate Medical Education. And Julia, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Mark.
And you all can join us, as I said here, 410-319-8888 to join in this conversation. So we've had this unprecedented number of last year of measles cases, 662, if I have the number right, so we're in that realm. And then this outbreak at Disneyland, and you've seen people who are refusing vaccines. So there's both a political and a health risk here. But let me ask you first, why do we think this has been this upsurge in measles?
Well, I think there are two things. One is that there are parts of the world where measles still exists, and the outbreak linked to Disneyland is thought to have been introduced from the Philippines, where there's a very large outbreak of measles that's been going on for some time. And when even one person with measles is introduced into a community where there are even a small number of unimmunized people, this very, very contagious disease can spread among those who are unvaccinated. And those unvaccinated people can include people who have refused vaccine, people who are ineligible for vaccine by virtue of either their age or underlying illnesses that prevent them from being able to respond to vaccine, or people, which is fortunately an increasingly smaller group of people, those who don't have access to immunizations.
I mean, is that still an issue here in America, Dr. Berry, where people don't have access to vaccinations?
There can be people that don't have access to vaccinations, but it is an increasingly smaller problem. As Julia was saying, we have vaccines for children. We have a national program that seeks to bring vaccines to all children. But there are pockets of people in the United States that still don't have good access to health care, including children without good access to health care.
Now, let me come back to February 1998 for a moment and the Lancet publication by Dr. Andrew Wakefield, where he was positing this kind of this connection between gastric problems, the MMR vaccine, which is the vaccine for measles and other things we'll talk about again in a moment, and autism. And it was an explosion. But he wasn't the first nor the last person to talk about a link between vaccinations and autism. And that particular study was completely discredited, both his research and not just because he just went to 12 people to make a study on rather than hundreds of people, and also that even they then said that some of his research was falsified. So that was kind of but that didn't end the conversation. Let's get right down to the heart of what people's fear. Let me start here with Dr. Andrew Berry, then go to Dr. Drew McMillan, about people's fear about the relationship between the vaccine and multiple vaccines and autism.
Well, I think that when a disease, a vaccine-preventable disease like measles is common, people are not as afraid of the vaccine because they're afraid of the actual disease that the vaccine is preventing. But as those diseases become uncommon, people forget what measles looks like and what how it presents and the devastation, death, or permanent brain damage or pneumonia and morbidity that those diseases can cause. And then, you know, parents are, conscious of what they give to their children, and they're out of good intentions wanting to make good choices for their children. And then meanwhile, if misinformation comes along, through faulty science or through unsubstantiated science, that can really take hold on parents' fears. And so I think that's where this is coming from. As diseases become more in the spotlight, like, for example, in our current measles outbreak, I think that there's now more of an interest in vaccination. And I think that's a good thing because the measles vaccine is safe and effective. And when people are vaccinated against measles, they're protected and communities are protected.
Julia?
Yeah. So I agree with everything that Andrea said. I would just add that I think if you look back, so the Wakefield study raised some concern about autism, and as you say, that study has been discredited, and frankly so has Dr. Wakefield for ethical reasons as well as science. But then there was this appreciation that autism seemed to be increasing, first slightly, and then more recently it appears more aggressively increasing.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a temporal relationship between being immunized and when autism develops. Most children who have autism are not born autistic. That develops during their first or second year or third year of life, at the same time that many immunizations are being given. Nobody likes to think that their child just had bad luck or bad genes. And so I think people look for an explanation for an unfortunate circumstance. So vaccines began to be blamed, and sort of around the same time, it was recognized that with our increasing ability to protect children from disease, with more vaccines, there was this preservative that while it was only there in very small amounts in any individual vaccine, it was accumulating in the large number of vaccines that children were getting. That preservative is called thimerosal, and it allows children to be immunized with multi-dose vials. You don't have to have a single vial of vaccine for every individual child. Out of a total abundance of caution, thimerosal has been removed from all vaccines that are given to children, and autism rates continued to rise. The thimerosal, the mercury that is in that preservative, is not the mercury that does cause brain damage. That mercury that causes brain damage is called methyl mercury. The mercury that's in thimerosal is ethyl mercury. There's no evidence that ethyl mercury in the concentrations that were included in vaccines is related to any kind of adverse consequences. But all of that piled up, and people, I think, began to basically grasp at straws, thinking that perhaps autism could be prevented by not immunizing.
And what about studies going on, Andrea Berry, to make these connections? Are there people doing research to see if there's more here that meets the eye? Because this is the popular wisdom.
Right. So in regards to MMR and autism, the way to study the relationship between whether something is causing something else, like whether MMR vaccine causes autism or whether they're just happening at the same time, that MMR vaccines given to one-year-olds and autism is often diagnosed in the second year of life. So the way to study that is with really large epidemiologic studies where you can have large populations of children who have either received MMR vaccine or not received MMR vaccine, and then look at the rates of autism in the two groups. And there have been numerous studies designed exactly that way that have failed to find a relationship between MMR and autism. So I think that that particular vaccine and chronic illness is definitely not linked causally. And I think that's the correct way to study it, not to look at individuals in small numbers, but to look at large populations. So that's, in general, vaccine safety is an active topic. There are recent meta-analyses of these studies. I don't know how many more studies are going to be done on the particular link between MMR and autism, though, because I think in the scientific community, it's accepted that it's not linked.
So we have some emails coming in, and folks, join us here at 410-319-8888. Kimberly wrote an email in at talk@steinershow.org, and she says, "Dear Mark, government officials are playing health politics with the recent measles outbreak. In a nation of 320 million people, we must ask, do 84 cases really warrant this news coverage? Clearly, the outbreak is being used to advance a quote-unquote pro-vaccine agenda. Yet there's another side of the story. Live vaccines can and do spread diseases." And she cites a organization that I am not aware of, the Weston A. Price Foundation, which is a nutrition education foundation, that in the piece that I don't have time to read this whole thing, but that the thing that vaccine recipients can carry diseases in the back of their throat and affect others while displaying no symptoms of disease. Numerous scientific studies indicate children who receive live virus vaccination can shed disease and infect others for weeks and even months afterwards. Thus, parents who vaccinate their children can indeed put others at risk. And this is being written by Leslie Manukian, who is a documentary filmmaker who made the film The Greater Good, to open a dialogue about vaccine safety, and that both unvaccinated and vaccinated individuals are at risk from exposure to those recently vaccinated. Vaccine failure is widespread, and that perhaps people should be isolated once they get vaccinated. So how do we respond? This is, a very serious notion that many people think. How do we respond to this?
So MMR vaccine is a live vaccine. So MMR stands for measles, mumps, and rubella, and those are three viruses. And the vaccine contains...
I had the first two as a child.
Okay. There you go. And the vaccine contains those three viruses, and they're attenuated, meaning they're grown until they're not as virulent and active. And so just active enough to give the vaccine to a person and have them develop an immune response that keeps them, that prevents them from getting the disease. The virus is not readily transmissible to others for weeks. I think there actually was a lot of misinformation in the email that you just read. It's a very safe vaccine. It is live, but it is attenuated.
Julia? Yeah, just add that when vaccines are developed, this is actually one of the things that's looked at most carefully to be certain that, in fact, first I should say that most of the vaccines that are given to children are not live vaccines. That is, they can't possibly be transmitted from one person to another. But as Andrea said, the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine is a live vaccine that's attenuated to be safe. Its safety is very, very carefully evaluated, partly because we don't want healthy children to be infected by this virus, but also because we know there are children who are not healthy who might be exposed to other children who've been immunized. Now, it's interesting that we used the fact that the virus can be spread from one person to another when polio was eradicated in this country. It was eradicated because people were immunized, but also because it was not the polio vaccine that we use today, but the polio vaccine that was introduced by Dr. Sabin was a live vaccine that actually continues to live in the GI tracts of the children who are immunized and is shed in their stool. That means that a child who's in contact with them in daycare or in some in a household could, in fact, be exposed to that vaccine virus. That actually was very helpful. The vaccine virus didn't cause polio, but it did promote immunity even among people who were not actually infected by the wild virus or by the vaccine. So sometimes it's helpful, but the safety, the transmissibility of vaccines like measles or mumps or rubella is carefully looked at, and it's very well established that those viruses are not spread from a person who's been immunized by a shot in the arm to a household contact, a daycare contact, a school contact, or anyone else.
Before I have another question, let me go to the phones first. The folks were calling in at 410-319-8888 to talk about vaccines and the danger or lack of danger in vaccines, why we're having this outbreak of measles, and what our public response should be, especially in the face of much of the onslaught politically that's been going on around this right now, at 410-319-8888, as we talked with Dr. Julia McMillan from Hopkins and Dr. Andrea Berry from Maryland. And Stephanie, on the road, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, thank you very much. I'm a parent of a generation that did not vaccinate my children, and now my son is of age where he has to consider vaccinating his. And so he asked me, Mom, what about this? Why are we not vaccinating? What is the issue? And I tell you, I had to wrestle with it when I was a young mom. I have all four children grown, and everybody's alive and doing well, but I also had alternative health cares and a way to keep my children healthy. But my question, one of the things that was so powerful to me when I was considering if I should or shouldn't give the vaccine was the stories of the parents that did have a very sunny, happy child going in to the immunization, and when they came out after a fever and an obvious response to the vaccine, they say their child was just absolutely not the same child. And I trust parents' instinct, and I know that they know what their children are like 24/7, they're with them, and so what do we say to those parents that really do believe there's a connection, and how are we looking into their experience and what we can do to ascertain why that is the case with more than just a handful of parents?
Stephanie, that's a great question, and I think you put it much more succinctly than I even tried to do at the top of the show. I appreciate the call. Let's talk about this, Andrea and Julia. I mean, I think that this what Stephanie's raising is, to me, at the heart of this issue of reluctance and fear.
Right. The first thing that I think of or say to a parent in this situation is, you know, how sympathetic I feel towards their child, for example, not being neurologically normal or, you know, something has happened. And I think that we can't forget that there are parents with children who have, like, for example, a chronic neurological illness or condition. But I go back to whether or not it was the vaccine or not. And although a neurological condition can kind of present itself in the, you know, second year of life, for example, it doesn't mean that the vaccine caused it. And I think it's very powerful when there is kind of a very strong temporal association and a parent will say, you know, the vaccine was, you know, Monday and Tuesday this all started. And that feels very powerful. And that's why we need good studies to look at whether there really are causes. I think there really are those studies. There are cases of neurological illnesses. There's a case of a neurological illness that after the fact was found to have a genetic underbasis. But before that was known, it was a concern among parents with children with this illness. It was a concern that it was the vaccine caused it. And then, you know, later on, somebody was able to find the actual DNA mutation that was associated with the illness and to say it wasn't the vaccine. So it's an active area of research, and it should be, because we should be trying to figure out what the true underpinnings of these illnesses are.
And Julia, let me, as you pick up on that, because what Stephanie said, I think, is also, I mean, I think that everybody in my world, in my circle of immediate friends, many of whom don't trust a lot of Western medicine, and many of whom try to live an alternatively healthy life in terms of what they eat and what they do, I mean, there is a fear that there's this connection, and that we don't spend enough time and money kind of investigating that connection and the anecdotal kind of things that Stephanie was talking about, that, as you said, it comes out of maternal wisdom in some ways.
The first thing I would say to Stephanie is that I'm delighted that her four children grew up to be healthy. But part of the reason why they were at much reduced risk of the diseases that vaccines protect against is that everybody else was immunized.
What do you mean by that?
I mean everybody may be an exaggeration.
Right. That's an interesting connection. I want you to kind of parse that out a little bit.
Well, we have school laws that require that children who go to school in this country are immunized. In some states, those laws are looser than in others. In every state, there's a potential exemption for health reasons. In all states except two, West Virginia and Mississippi, there's an exemption for religious beliefs. And then I think it's 17 states where parents can simply say that they have a personal belief against immunizations. And that is thought to be the reason why there is such a large, well, it's known to be the reason why there's such a large percentage of children in California, for example, especially in certain pockets of California, where there are children who are not immunized. But the vast majority of children, and in Maryland, it's 95% by age 3 for virtually all of the immunizations that are recommended for children, have been immunized by the time they go to school. So they're protected. And because they're protected, those illnesses don't persist in our schools. So there's no measles in Maryland schools. There's no mumps. There's occasional mumps because that vaccine is not quite as effective as the measles vaccine is. The measles vaccine is 99% protective for children who've been immunized with the recommended two doses. It's 95% effective for children who've received one dose. And so Stephanie's children were protected from those infections, including some that cause meningitis, the very neurologic diseases that many people used to suffer from before the vaccines were available. And those vaccines protect the spread of infection to the children whose parents have refused them.
Let me return to the phones here. 4103. Thank you so much for that call, Stephanie. 410-319-8888. Jamar in Catonsville, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning, Jamar.
Yes, I'm a person who decided not to vaccinate my child, and that's because of the certain additives that are clearly toxic that's in the vaccine, such as mercury and formaldehyde and aluminum. I would be a lot more receptive and probably would be okay with vaccines if they didn't have those toxic elements in there. Could you answer why they're in there, and what can be done to remove them? Also, I found that they're not always effective, and that a lot of cases of disease have also been greatly mitigated due to proper sanitation, sterilization, hand washing, and so forth.
The two questions. Both questions are good, and I think, Julia, you tackled earlier this question of formaldehyde, but let's do this again about formaldehyde, aluminum, mercury. Are they in vaccines? Why are they in vaccines?
So there's no more mercury in any vaccine that's recommended for children, with the exception of some of the makers of influenza vaccine. But there are mercury-free or thimerosal-free influenza vaccines as well. So no vaccines sold in the United States for use in children, except for those certain brands of influenza vaccine, have thimerosal in them any longer. Formaldehyde, I don't think, is in any vaccine. I don't think it's ever been in any vaccine. Maybe Andrea can correct me. To the degree that there is aluminum there, that aluminum is one of the things that helps the vaccine prompt the immune system. It's put in there because it causes the vaccine to be more effective. And there are, in fact, new. Those products are called adjuvants, and there are new adjuvants being explored every day to make vaccines like influenza, which we know is not as protective as we would like it to be more protective.
Want to add to that at all, Andrew, before we go back to the phones?
So with regards to formaldehyde, I think that the whole cell pertussis vaccine may have had formaldehyde in it, and I'm not sure if any currently licensed vaccines do. But in general, there are additives in vaccines that are meant to do things such as keep the vaccines from getting contaminated, bacterial contamination, or that are part of the manufacturing process. But all the additives are there when the vaccines are tried in studies to see whether they work to prevent disease and to see whether they're safe. They're all part of what is studied when we study vaccines. And I'm not certain about the formaldehyde.
Or mercury.
For the mercury, as Julia said, it is no longer present in our childhood vaccines.
So let me get back. Stephanie has called back in with another point she wanted to make before we have to wind up our conversation. Stephanie, please come back.
Yes. Thank you very much for taking this, Dr. Julia. I appreciate your point. And I'd just like to say my children actually did get measles, even though they were raised in the 80s and 90s. And they fought it off because they were healthy. They had good nutrition. They didn't live in an impoverished area, and maybe I was lucky, I don't know, but they did have just normal childhood reactions to it. I understand that when you do live and you're compromised in an area because of nutrition, you're much more vulnerable. But I had the additional stress of living overseas for much of my child-rearing years, where I was much more exposed to these diseases in a way that made me feel very vulnerable, and ultimately I decided it was not worth the mental anguish of wondering if I was right or wrong or putting my children at risk. So when they were older and they came back to the States, I immunized them for polio and tetanus. The rest they still are not immunized against. But the reasoning at the time was because of my belief in alternative health and the luck of where I was born, I felt I could not do that and still be okay and responsible as a parent. Thank you for letting me share.
I'm accepting. Glad you called back with that thought. What were you thinking of just then, Andrea? Julia?
Yeah, well, I don't know what to say except that measles, most children with measles do get better. I had measles, and I understand from your comment, Mark, that you did
I
as
did
well.
Too, yeah.
Two children who out of every 1,000 who get measles will die. Trained in medicine in an era in which measles was being eliminated. We still saw it, but it was being eliminated. And one of the first children I ever saw died from measles. This was a teenager who was completely healthy before she got measles. And watching her die was agonizing. So though I think Stephanie was lucky, and I was lucky, and most children, 998 out of 1,000, will be lucky in that they don't die. But out of those 1,000 children who get measles, and most of whom will survive, some of them will get ear infections, some of them will get pneumonia, some of them will get encephalitis and have permanent brain damage. I think it's really important that people do understand that measles in particular is a potentially devastating disease, even for children who are healthy.
And I think this has been a very important conversation, because I think that we have this, as you'll hear in our next conversation, which has to do about sports. When we don't understand what's going on, there's a deep fear, and that fear leads to these theories that don't always hold water. And I want you to have the two of you on to kind of walk through this. And I deeply appreciate the time both of you have taken. We just heard from Dr. Julia McMillan, who's Executive Vice Chair of the Department of Pediatrics at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, also Professor of Pediatrics and Associate Dean for graduate medical education. Julia, thanks so much for being with us and taking your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Mark.
And the same Dr. Andrea Aberry, who is Assistant Professor in the Division of Infectious Diseases and Tropical Pediatrics in the Department of Pediatrics and Medicine at the Center for Vaccine Development at the University of Maryland School of Medicine, for coming in studio today. Andrew, thank you so much. Lovely to meet you. Thank you for being in studio.
Thank you.
And our way to break here, I want to remind you all to join us next Thursday on February the 12th at 7:30 for a screening and discussion on the film Food Chains, which is about a group of Florida farm workers fighting to improve working conditions, the Immokalee workers, for farm laborers all across America. It's co-sponsored by Baltimore Food and Faith Project and the Center for a Livable Future and our Center for Emerging Media. More information at redemmis.org. Please join us there for that live discussion. And on our way to break here, we are hearing the Bee Gees, Staying Alive. which hit number one on this day in 1978. We'll come right back with Dave Zirin and talk about what happened at the end of that Super Bowl. Don't go away.